Accession number 12922, Squadron Leader Ronald Meredith, Reel 3.
Squadron Leader Meredith, Reel 3.
I was talking about the Americans and the local community. As I said, gradually numbers were building up, and the fact is that the locals were quite used to Americans being around the area. And the things which gelled in my mind as a result of this were the three things that seemed apparent. Firstly, I was coming back from the station one day in a taxi, and the chappy said to me, he said, "Oh," he says, you're on the base." "Yeah." I said, "Right." He said, "What are the numbers going to be like up there?" I said, "I have no idea." I said, "You know, there will be a build-up." He said, "Oh," he says, "that's good." He said, "You know," he says, "my dad used to run a taxi business." He said, "He virtually lived off Greenham Common." He says, "I've just got my own cab at the moment, but," he says, "I've got a couple of brothers who want to come in." He says, "With this build-up, you know, it can't be bad for us." He says, "You know." He says, "They've been warned about drinking and driving. We know we often take them back from the pub." He says, "There's plenty of them there, plenty of trade for the taxi man," which was, you know, excellent. The other interesting thing was one of my American colleagues, and he was a colleague, we used to shoot together over at Welford. He, I found out, had been based in the UK for 8 years. And he was, on paper anyway, posted from Greenham Common to Welford because he'd asked to stay there. Now, he'd had his own house in Newbury for 6 years, and at this stage, although house prices, Newbury, always an expensive-ish area, but there were still a lot of Americans were buying houses on the economy. They chose to. They wanted to live there. Of course, many of them were married to Brits from previous tours in the UK. But there were quite a lot of them actually living in the community. And the final thing was that, of course, people who've never been to the UK before, they want to have a look around. Newbury was the nearest town, so that's where they came. And I don't know what the direct contribution would be in terms of money from the Americans who were at the base, but certainly in terms of what we would see as, in those days, the rates. My Ministry of Defence establishments, they do pay rates, not the same as you or I, but there is a rating element included, which the Ministry of Defence pays to the local authority. And as the base expands and facilities increase, then the amount of that contribution also increases. So there's a substantial amount of money coming into the district council as a result of the expansion and the development of the base. But I say that was an aside, but these were features which were in people's mind at the time. Now, I was talking about the Remembrance Day parade earlier on and the problems that caused, but the ripple effect of the demonstrations at Greenham Common went out further. As a result of the necessity to acquire additional housing for the Americans, and remember, we weren't going to desecrate all these beautiful woodland areas around Greenham. There was an old naval site called HMS Dauntless, which was out near Burfield at Reading, which I actually took over from the Navy. It was covered in wooden huts and things. These were all going to be demolished to be turned into merry quarters, or as a building site for merry quarters. We didn't waste Ministry of Defence guards or security on it. We stuck Security Corps in there. But because it was associated, or had become associated with Greenham Common, all of a sudden CND move out there and put on a demonstration at HMS Dauntless, as was, or we rechristened it because it's on a road called Clay Hill. We called it Clay Hill Site. So we had to mobilise Thames Valley Police resources, in fact, to look after this. And the same, we had minor demonstrations at Welford, because they associated Welford with the Greenham Common, as it happens. There was an expansion going on at Welford anyway. We were pushing a road in from the M4 through to the base. Again, that was in the interest of the community. Welford is an ammunition dump, no secret from that. A lot of heavy traffic, but at that time, you just have to come through the little villages of Great Shefford and Channelworth, the bottom of Channelworth. So to avoid that, we got permission to put a road in off the motorway. It's there now, you can see it's got a big sign up, works access only. But there's a demonstration there. Now, in fairness, this was a rather stupid demonstration, but it's illustrative of the way things go. My brief was to avoid trespass, or allowing trespassers onto our land if we could, and we generally used MOD police to keep them out. Welford, the security at Welford was provided by the United States police, the air police. So when this demonstration mounted on the doorstep, literally outside the main gate, I had to send Ministry of Defence police across to move them. Now, it's always a touchy business, this business of evicting people off land. Although we were within our rights to do so, it was normally necessary to get approval from the ministry before we took precipitous action that might attract the media. And I think about 9 o'clock at night, I rang the resident clerk, who was the chap we would normally talk to. Oh Lord, he says, I don't know how we handle this, so I need to get the ministers for me. I said, well, it's all right. I can't remember whether it was Jerry Wiggins, whoever it was, whoever the minister was. I'd been up to London, I'd been briefing about the situation, the development on the base, as well as the, I mean, it wasn't really interested in the CND activity or anything. It was more how the base was developing, were we on programme, were we on schedule. We had to regularly brief ministers on this. But anyway, I had his number, I rang him at home, I said, look, if I get these people off now at this time of night, I said, they'll be off by the morning, and that's it. So if we leave them here till tomorrow morning, the world and his wife will be along here with their cameras. Which I said, all right, I said, if you can cope with it peacefully, which we did. We merely evicted them, and that was it. Seven large Ministry of Defence policemen, would you mind moving your tent, sir? And they seemed to think it was a good idea, and they moved their tent, but they went on to the local farmer's land just opposite. Now, bless him, the farmer had been somewhat inconvenienced by work at the other end of the base, right, where we're going to push this road route through to the M4. But I rang him at home and said, look, I'm sorry, but I've had to evict some guys, and they're on your land. I said, I can not do a thing to help you. I said, they're now right outside my territory. I'm telling you now, so if you want to call up the local gendarmerie from the Thames Valley, they may be able to do it. He said, oh, lovely old Berkshire farmer. He said, don't worry, Ron. He said, I think I know how. And good is his word. And it was 6:30 in the morning. They started spraying the field with slurry. And the slurry truck just came straight past this tent, sprayed the lot of them, lay up sticks, left the tent, and disappeared. And that was it. And I thought that was rather nice, sort of local farming poetic justice. And it solved the problem for him. We couldn't obviously have done anything like that, but the local farmer seemed to think that was his way. But we were at great pains in all situations to avoid putting any of the demonstrators in a situation where they could complain about actions by the Ministry of Defence police. I can't speak for the Thames Valley police, but I'm sure their brief was equally the same. Courtesy at all times. Now, there were two reasons for this, really. A, it was policy, and B, we were not so daft as to realise that these people were probably wired for sound, and everything that has been said by the policeman were going to be buzzed back to some cameraman with his, you know, giant lens on the other side of the fence. So it would not have been in the interests of the police to have taken precipitous action that caused problems. Now, we know, again, for our own purposes, we had to take our own videos too, and you will see different videos, one taken from the other side of the fence, and one taken from inside of the fence. And, you know, girl is moving along perfectly well, and somebody says to her, right, now start acting, the cameras are obviously running, and then starts throwing herself about and even starting to pull her own clothing off, saying the police have done it. Well, we were never, ever caught for that. We were able to prove quite categorically we didn't do it. There was an awful lot of agent provocateur type activity going on. Now, obviously, I could not be everywhere, and I was not everywhere, and I didn't see everything that went on. But the policy was that we didn't cause offence. The policy was we used minimum restraint and always politeness. It was very difficult, and I can say this, particularly for the young policemen, and later on when they had young servicemen involved, to keep their cool in a situation like this. They were being provoked, very, very significantly provoked. But that was the job we had to do.
Do you think it's more difficult with women than men, or sort of a mix?
Much more so, because the men would, if a man reacted and got out of hand, you could, you know, put your arm around his waist and another arm lock on him and march him off. If you try the same with a woman, they'll say they've been assaulted. So, you know, we were very conscious of this. The police had to be very, very careful. And as far as possible, they were. But as I said, it was not beyond many of these, particularly the more militant elements, to say to start peeling off their clothes and things and say, oh, they've been assaulted by the police. But so, to my certain knowledge, this did not go on.
Were there many claims, though, that women had been assaulted or beaten, that, you know, violence had been used against them?
I honestly don't think there were. I'm sure, I have a feeling there was the odd one, but I certainly have no direct remembrance of anything like this going on at all. But I say, I do know the situations were provoked. And I'll mention that later on in the context of some of the demonstrations and the things that people got up to. I mean, we did have a situation where I know one policeman had his hands lacerated because the girl he picked up in the brief by this stage was took them under the arms to lift them. And she'd got a leather belt with razor blades onto it. I mean, this type of thing was being done. Even worse things, you know, sort of used sanitary towels and things like this were put about the person. It really was. It was quite nasty. But by and large, I think that the guys came out of it quite well. But to say, as far as these demonstrations were concerned, at this stage, we're still, I say, apart from regular, smallish scale demonstrations, there was nothing untoward. But the camps were building up in various places around the camp, and this was where the council started to get involved. Basically, there were complaints from, again, local citizens that these camps were not only unsanitary, unhygienic, they were causing litter. And again, there was an interesting, and again, I think it could be found as a letter from somebody who claimed to be in Greenpeace, but disassociated themselves from a Greenpeace element at one of the gates. They said, well, my version of Greenpeace is that we don't go around tearing up trees and saplings and pulling up shrubs to feed our bonfires. And leaving litter and plastic bags and things around that can cause all manner of problems. Some of these sites, they really were squalid. Now, I mean, they then turned around to the council and said, well, you better provide us with refuse collection services and things like this. And the council were in a very, very difficult situation from an environmental health point of view. We were quite genuinely surprised that they did just arbitrarily close these camps and condemn them. But for whatever reason, they didn't seem to be able to do this. They provided with them with some sort of refuse collection service. The post office eventually started delivering mail, for goodness sake. But it was fairly evident from the outset that some of these people were going to stay there, whatever. And that was it. They were professional demonstrators, as far as I was concerned.
Were you involved? You know, it's interesting you mentioning from the outset. And I wondered if you were involved at all or whether you witnessed the initial march and the chaining to the gate. I understand some women did that.
Some women did chain themselves to the gate. In fact, we had people chaining themselves to the fence in all sorts of odd places. But for us, this wasn't a particular problem. I mean, we were a pair of bolt croppers, and that was it. I mean, we were able to cut more chains than they were able to provide locks and chains. It wasn't a problem. It was a symbolic thing. I mean, you're going back here to, in terms of the women's movement, you're going back to the suffragettes and chaining themselves to the railings. I mean, it's merely a continuation of that process, a manifestation of female protest. Fine, they're entitled to protest, but it didn't cause us any particular problems. In fairness, I think at some stage, you know, depending where they were, we're quite happy to let them stay there. I mean, they did this for the cameras. I mean, we've seen this. It wasn't, I don't recollect this on the very first demonstration, but certainly one of the other demonstrations. They all ceremonially chained themselves together, and once the photographs were taken, they took the chains off and carried on doing other things. I mean, there was somebody behind this, a lot of this, in my humble opinion, organising it. I would actually go so far as to use the term applying psychological warfare. Very well trained in the use of the media. Exceedingly well trained in the use of the media. And later on, in some of the bigger demonstrations, provided with very sophisticated communications. And, I mean, we could listen in. And there were people orchestrating the whole thing. Move from here, move from there. We knew they were listening to us. All right, that suited our purpose fine. We had other channels that they couldn't access. But, you know, we were saying, right, we're going to move a convoy out now, for example. We're going to A gate. Well, they knew A gate as, I don't know, maybe Blue gate or whatever. And you had to say, right, there's a convoy coming out. All the girls or move around to such and such place. We'll be here in 5 minutes. And, you know, wait until they'd moved away from one of the other gates. And then we'd use one of our discrete channels and direct the vehicles to go out through the other way. But chaining, I mean, we had this on one occasion, I do recollect, where somebody tried to chain themselves to a portion of the fence that was being removed. Again, we had, we called them the chain gang. They belonged to the Property Services Agency, PSA. They were a super bunch, and this was, we were jumping in time sequence now to some of the larger demonstrations when we had to move our people on and off base by convoy, just for very limited periods. But they saw that we'd removed a particular piece of fence somewhere, and thought, oh, obviously, next time we go out, we'll use that piece of fence. So they chained themselves to it. But, you know, we just used another piece of fence, you know, a couple of hundred yards along, and left them there. You know, they didn't cause any particular problems. So this sort of thing did happen, but it didn't cause us any real problems. But I was saying, they say that this spread of the demonstrations away from Greenham Common, and we found here that whilst it didn't cause us any greater problems at Greenham Common, it did move the problem around. And you see, they tried to capitalise on this at one stage, and again, I'm not quite sure when it was. I have a feeling we must be moving up to about 1982, but there was this attempt to link arms from Aldermaston to Greenham Common, and this was it was advertised as a very large demonstration, and in fairness it was. It was a very, very big demonstration. But although the media, who tend to support all the anything that's anti-establishment, anti-government, anti-military, seems to be supported by the media as far as we could see, they said, oh yes, this chain had been completed and all this. Absolute rubbish it wasn't, because we took photographs from the air, and it was painfully obvious that the chain was not completed from Greenham. But that was portrayed as a victory, that they had achieved this, although we were able to prove quite satisfactorily that it was not. So, saying is that there was a movement behind all of this, organising and arranging it. And this goes way beyond the actual demonstrations. It goes into things like organising the coaches. We would find, for example, in some demonstrations, you would find great sections of the fence line, all with the same banners, all with the same symbols. They'd all been provided with the same coloured paint to daub on the road or whatever it was, and they came and organised bands from various places. And by various means, we had all these coaches being paid for out of some slush fund. Others who'd contributed to their own transportation, who were just as conscientious and just as diligent in their belief that they were correct to demonstrate, but a slightly different approach as to how they did it. They weren't, shall I say, in the same category as either the great unwashed or the most militant. You could notice a difference here. And certainly there was a fair amount of funding for the organisation. I expect it is known how most of the funds were acquired. And certainly there was a modest private subscription from individuals. Certainly I have seen people handing over money at the gates, but I think the biggest whack used to come from the press. We have in fact recorded, and somewhere in my notes I've actually even got the names of it. Oh yes, here we are. 7th of February 1982, 10:04, Bulgarian diplomatic car, and I've even got the number plates. Was at the gate taking pictures of these people and passing over bundles of money. We had an East German television crew on another occasion doing exactly the same sort of thing. I've even got names here. So this is just out of my diary, funnily enough. Here we are. Soviet television crew. Shoshinkin and Vilashenko. Again, with their vehicle number at the time, 12th of February 1982. Dishing out wadges of cash for taking photographs. That's merely a backhanded way of subsidising the movement. This was going on. I mean, this is where this was coming in, and there was much more of this going on. We found, for example, that they would target events of local significance. I've already mentioned Remembrance Days and things like this, and the A-bomb explosions. But gradually, as the demonstrations built up, they would start targeting Washington's birthday or American public holidays as an event for a demonstration, and all this has attracted a certain amount of attention. Now, the one thing that came through all of this, of course, was that there was them outside and us on the inside, and I'm reminded of one occasion which. And I'm now starting to become illogical, I suspect. I'm going out of date sequence here, but it was just talking about the demonstrators. That, I think fairly early on in the demonstration, some of them tapped into a water supply that was just outside the fence. This was no problem to us. Again, as a military establishment, we have water hydrants all over the place. And this particular hydrant would have been on base until they moved the fence back, I presume, many years ago. and by agreement with the local authority, in particular the local fire brigade, this hydrant, which was outside the base but close to one of the campsites that were used by the demonstrators, this hydrant was active. And you know, they were taking water from it, which was no problem. It didn't bother. We could have turned it off at any time. But in fact, you know, we left it there. They did have kids. Again, one might regard it as compassionate. I seem to remember even it was summertime, but we left the water on. But bearing in mind, we were trying to develop the base. And part of the development program, because bearing in mind we're bringing in nuclear weapons, we had to move more water supplies down to the storage areas. We had to realign the fire hydrant system, the whole firefighting capability of the base. So we were at this stage in the process of realigning hydrant systems. So eventually we did have to cut the thing off. And you know, they thought we did it deliberately. Well, in fairness, of course we did it. It wasn't deliberately done to deprive them of water. We could have done that the first time we spotted them using it. It was part of the continuing maintenance program on the base and upgrading the system, and that particular line was coming right out of the system. In fact, it wasn't just the line from inside the base to outside the base, it was from much further up in the base that we were putting whole new lines. So this was an action on our part, which again they tended to capitalise on, say we were being beastly to them and all this sort of thing, in point of fact. It was just part of the ongoing progress of the base. But I'm reminded here, when we come up to we're now into 1982 in March. Again, from my notes here, we did have a very large demonstration in March. And this was the first attempt to blockade all of the gates of the base. Now, again, this was manifestly unsuccessful. I've explained to you that we had our chain gang, these guys from the PSA who'd open up any section of fence. The gates were almost of academic interest to us. We didn't use the main gate very much anyway. And we could organise the convoys, and we could move on and off the base at will. I mean, to a blind man, the number of access roads and positions to Greenham Common, you'd need a darn sight more people than they were ever able to muster to totally isolate the place. So we were able to do this. I mean, to add to a little bit of frustration, we did deliberately fly in some of our Ministry of Defence police, for example, rather than having them to face the gauntlet. As much as anything else, this was a little bit of provocation on our part to let them see that it didn't matter. We could still come in and out. I mean, the convoys were still going in and out, but we just, to make the point, and we deliberately landed the police where they could be seen to be coming in and out. So, well, you know, your line doesn't mean anything. But that was, as a particular, I think it was about the 20th, 21st of March that this happened. Again, they tried on the 22nd. I suspect that must have been a holiday period. At no time was this particularly significant. Moving into April, we had a series of religious groups from Reading that came out to demonstrate, and I believe this was supposed to be an ecumenical group representing everything from all the Christian religions plus the Jewish and some of the ethnic varieties. But again, this was I only remember this because it was very widely advertised that this was religion against the bomb. And I think the Thames Valley Police estimated there were fractionally less than 200 people there, so it wasn't terribly successful. And they thought that they would be able to bring in very large numbers. They were less successful than the next one, which was organised by the students' unions from various colleges and universities, particularly Southampton and Reading. But again, this was, I would say, another shot in the foot. Again, our estimated numbers was about 700 on this particular demonstration, but we'd estimate that about 90% of those were punks and rockers and hooligan elements. And whilst one can respect the students' union, and yes, we know they tend to have left-wing persuasions, that's their right, but by and large responsible. They can be noisy and vociferous, but one can generally recognise a band of students as opposed to a band of what are so loosely called hippies. And this was the thing that we were finding, that gradually, to make up numbers, the other groups, I mean, skinheads, you name it, what they were, hippies mainly, of various persuasions, sort of attached themselves to all these demonstrations. And from my point of view, sitting inside the fence looking out, really this was, you know, undermining really the activities of some of the organisers of the demonstrations. And this just did present some problems. again in that year, in April, it went right through past Easter, but it didn't stop. Other activities on the base. I know Southampton University were back on the 22nd of April. Then on the 23rd, there was a march to Burfield. But on the 25th of April, the SAF Glenn Miller Band, which is a sort of heirs and successors, they were playing downtown Newbury. They were playing in Wantage. I was at Wantage Town Hall that evening where they were playing. There was an attempt to interfere with them when they were playing in downtown Newbury. Bearing in mind, you've got the base with, you know, fair numbers of use the sort of expression that was being bandied around at the time, dissident tribeswomen lurking around the place, and yet there's the base officials in RAF or USAF uniform, together with the mayor, corporation and dignitaries and lots of guests, downtown having the 3rd Air Force band playing Glenn Miller music to them. It was a minor attempt in Newbury to stop it, but immediately the good worthy burghers, you know, of Newbury sort of evicted those who were attempting to stop it. So we remember Glenn Miller. You know, if it hadn't been for Glenn Miller and the 3rd Air Force during the war, probably we wouldn't have a Newbury or a UK now. So come on, what's it all about? And this is what we found interesting in many of these demonstrations, that the local people were far more effective in many ways than if you like, police. We didn't, as it happened, police this thing. Not with Ministry of Defence police. Thames Valley had a few people there, but it wasn't necessary. So I say, on the one hand, you've got the protest movement, and on the other hand, you've got life really going on as normal. And these sort of things were always rather refreshing and interesting. While this was going on, again, the construction side was really proceeding at pace, and there were some attempted incursions there. There were attempts to influence the workers on the site, and in fact, Tarmac, who I think were the prime contractors, actually sacked a couple of laddies, simply because they'd been seen associating with these girls on the other side. I mean, the girls were prepared to offer any favours just to suborn the individuals. So they were sacked without question. And I noted in my diary at the time that, in fact, on the 7th of June, I had a deputation, I used the word paddies, from the site, who sent a deputation to my office saying, "Begorra, sir, we're getting fed up with all of this. We're going to lose pay if these demonstrations are able to, you know, stop us working." I mean, I hasten to say, it hadn't been stopped working. But he says, "There's 50 of us down here with pick hell, sir, and we're prepared to knock 7 shades or whatnot out of these people if you let us go." You know, super reaction. But, you know, there's no way I could condone this sort of thing. And heaven help us, the police themselves, I mean the Thames Valley police, you know, couldn't have sanctioned anything. But this was, you know, I say this gang of paddies who were working on the building site were quite prepared to take action themselves, because they were worried that, you know, because of the convoy system, which when there were large scale demonstrations, just for everybody's safety, we used these convoys. That, of course, this meant it cut back on the overtime that was available. And these guys were getting a bit packed off, as it happened. I mean, the work were finished on schedule and there were absolutely no problems. But it was interesting sort of reaction to all of this. And again, back came Project Thrust, because I think he had an accident with his car in second. So he came back a third time and wiped up all the records. And I said, this is life going on as normal. And this was quite interesting. Now, we move into July of 83, and this was the what we call the wing activation, the 501st missile wing, GLCM wing, Ground Launch Cruise Missile Wing, was activated on the base on the 1st of July. And although we weren't ready to take the missiles on, the organisation required must start building up. So this is when we really started seeing a big build-up in numbers. And again, there was a demonstration outside because the media been invited, so therefore it was known that this was going to be happening, but it didn't impact on the ceremonies, and we had a cocktail party in the evening and all this sort of thing. It didn't impact on us, but it did start, it showed the start of a new venture, and this was really the fence cutting aspects. This is when it started, and the attempt was now to cut through the fence, to infiltrate the base, to suborn people who are working on the base, to try and prevent the tradesmen working on the sites, and to cause as much problem as they could. Now, to an extent, they would be reasonably successful in being able to cut the fence. I mean, as I said, it is not a high security fence, it's just a bog standard fence. And with 9 miles of perimeter, there's a limit to, you know, how frequently you can patrol the thing. And the thing that, again, must be remembered, and I feel that when all these incursions happened and the media said, oh, how easy it is to get onto the base, people forget that for a large part of its perimeter, there's forest or trees and bushes right up to the fence on both sides. It is like a mini jungle in places, and in fact, to get to the fence line, you had to get out of your vehicles and break through the undergrowth. Eventually, we were able to develop something like a Land Rover track. You needed a four-wheel drive vehicle to get through the trees. But in many places around there, it was tree-lined. And it was not very clever to say, oh, we've broken in. I mean, a small boy with a pair of pliers could get in, let alone a grown person with lots of nicely sharpened up bolt croppers and things. So it was a difficult thing to prevent. But having said that, there was not an awful lot to defend. It was a work site. It was a building site. There were no missiles there. And it doesn't matter how many people were going to be sitting around, it wasn't going to stop the missiles, and it certainly wasn't going to stop the completion of the work.